Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Rex Shalom Invest podcast. Every week, we write a newsletter on what is happening in the world and how that could impact on your wealth and investments. And this podcast picks through some of those highlights or lowlights. Week number 9 of 2024 is already upon us. Remember week 52, and then this year will be done as well. It just shows you how quickly this year is going. Dow Jones for the week, slightly down at 0.11%. The S&P 500 up 0.95%. And then tech heavy NASDAQ was up 1.74%. FTSE 100 ended slightly lower for the week. Euro Stoxx 50 up 0.44% for the week. Nikkei up 2.15%. We're going to talk a little bit about Japan a little bit later. And if we go across into China, Shanghai was up just marginally again at 0.74%. Looking at currencies, Rand against the dollar, 19.12. We've seen some strengthening of late as far as the Rand is concerned. Against the Euro, 20.71. And against the Great British Pound, 24.17. Bitcoin, $62,000, in case you were watching. And we're going to be talking about that as well a little bit later. Also joining the agenda, India, US office vacancies. And we're going to be talking about Weight Watchers International. Dawn, interesting week on markets. The bull market continues. That, I think, is I'm just surprised, and I continue to open up the screens every day and I continue just to see a bull market busy evolving in front of me. It has areas that are obviously quite frothy and where valuations are quite stretched. The big tech seven, or you know, the magnificent seven is what they talk about. That for me could be a stretch space in the market. But then we have the rest of the market that's slowly, slowly, slowly busy catching up. The big caveat here is earnings going to continue to underpin these valuations going into the rest of the year? Is inflation going to play along in the United States? And will interest rates drop? Because as you pointed out in the newsletter this week, perhaps the new normal is 4%. It's no longer going to be 2%, right?
Yes, I think that's very interesting. And it's interesting to look at what are the ramifications of that going forward. You know, part of the ramifications is that those interest rates are not going to drop as far as people might expect it. You know, we've had more than a decade, well, the US has had more than a decade of these ultra low interest rates, which quite frankly, they've become addicted to, Kobe, at the end of the day. It became their new normal. And so they've had to adjust to these much higher interest rates in America. And I think there's the expectation it's going to go back down to ultra low. I think this persistent inflation that, you know, just seems to stick at around about, you know, the 4% range is an indication that this is the new normal for them and they're going to have to adjust. And the most painful places, obviously, is going to be anybody wanting debt. It's going to be government debt, much more expensive government debt. It's something that we're having to live with in South Africa as well as the States. And then it's those high mortgage rates, which are going to impact on homeowners, and then corporates that are wanting to buy. And in the newsletter, I, you know, mention in a couple of places, real estate, corporate real estate offices specifically, where this work from home trend has been slowing. And there's been a pushback from corporates to actually reverse it. Quite frankly, I think it's a bit of a King Canute moment. I don't think they're going to be able to reverse it back to pre-pandemic levels. They're now sitting with these offices that the value's already dropped, but it hasn't dropped quite far enough for them to invest in converting it into retail real estate. And there's not the appetite, you know, people would need mortgages and interest rates are at an all-time high. So it's a very chaotic environment around that. And it's going to take the United States a while to sort of, you know, get accustomed to this new normal, because quite frankly, I think they've been sort of treading water and thinking, if we run this out long enough, we're going to get back to the new normal and, you know, nothing to see here, folks. But maybe that's not the case.
I mean, US CPI is now being reported at 3.1%. That's kind of the latest reading. And Dawn, I think it's changing. If inflation indeed stays at a higher level, which I think a lot of people are expecting, there's a lot of people saying, listen, don't expect going forward in this world that is potentially becoming less globalized, then inflation can just run at 2%. You know, inflation is going to perhaps could run at 3%, and as you quite rightly say in the newsletter, at 4% or somewhere in the range thereof. But think about it, because it changes the relationship between different asset classes. Suddenly, bonds become a viable asset class. So if you as a retiree in the United States or in Europe or in the UK can earn 3 or 4% out of yields, suddenly why just put money into equities? You could earn 4%. You know, as long as you're drawing down, and many of those investors don't draw down 5, 6, 7% of their capital, they're perhaps drawing down 3%, 4% of their capital. So suddenly fixed income becomes a viable asset class again, or equities that beat fixed income, or equities that have much higher dividend yields. So perhaps the focus also for companies going forward in the future is going to be a world whereby you don't just take your retained earnings and you try and grow your company, but you potentially put some of that back into the dividend pool so you can actually attract an investor base, a potential investor base with a higher dividend yield. So I think there's a major shift that's underway globally, especially if those rates continue to stay, as you've rightly said, between kind of the 3 and 4% level. Look, they go back to 2% or below 2%, and then we're back into that very anemic globalized world. But that'll be a tough thing for that to happen at this stage. You also write a very interesting piece on that U.S. office vacancies. You mentioned it just now. That's the overhang, right? So you've got this massive vacancies on the U.S. office side, and you're now sitting with these buildings, and now you've got to do something with them. And what is it that you're going to be doing with them? Because perhaps there's less people that want to make use of their office time, but they perhaps want to live more centrally. And then these things become interesting, you know, so to speak.
I think some of the things that are already being done, and they're even being done here in South Africa, is where you're getting a hybridized model where an entire office block is not entirely dedicated to residential or to office. But what you're getting is actually residential mixed with office, mixed with retail, you know, where you get the retail along the bottom, you then get a few floors of office, and then you get residential above that, which yes. I think makes an awful lot of sense, because then it's not an all or nothing. And the landlords can, you know, do it floor by floor as the demand, in fact, you know, ask for it, you know, maybe starting with the penthouse and sort of moving on down. I think it's a very interesting space to watch. Watching on all social media, the pushback from employees on the cancellation of work from home has been extremely interesting. And I do mention in the newsletter, you know, one thing that we need to remember is that in the US, employees are not protected to the same extent as Europeans and the British and us when it comes to labor. Yeah. When I spent quite a lot of time over there during the noughties, and I was astounded as to, you know, if you had leave, that was a benefit that was given to you, you know, and you were considered yourself extremely lucky if you got 2 weeks paid leave and maybe a couple of days sick leave, you know. It's, and maternity leave, I mean, that astounded me more than anything, because I mean, maternity leave has been built into our constitution for an awful long time, and the British for even longer. And in the States, you have no maternity rights built in at a federal level.
Yeah. Well, I mean, living centrally in the United States is incredibly expensive. Big cities, you want to live close to home, you want to live close into a hub, becomes incredibly, incredibly expensive. That's why you have nodes that are connected, you know, with transport, public transport, in order to try and get people into those nodes. If you can now suddenly purchase a unit inside the hub, and that you perhaps it's expensive, but it's perhaps not unaffordable, then, well, you might have a model. You might have people saying, well, listen here, a family is perhaps with, you know, before they have kids, perhaps want to live centrally. Or perhaps once they've had children, they just decide, listen, I'm not going to live out in the suburbs, you know, and try and commute in. You know, I'd rather live centrally. Also, living centrally gives you more shopping options. It gives you more options for variety and all of those kind of things. Whereas up to now, that has been only affordable for the very wealthy because the space is just, you know, so restricted. In this case, this might actually become something, you know, for the future. I know that if you go into, like, for instance, in South Africa, you go into Sandton, which is really the heart of the JSE. That's where the Johannesburg Stock Exchange is. The office vacancies are real in that space. And I know that many of the South African real estate investment trusts that are in that space are looking at potentially flipping them into something which you've just mentioned, Dawn, which is that mixed space type dwellings. And they've already done some of those, and those have certainly been successful. So maybe our cities start looking differently, and maybe how we live in those cities also become quite different. A place with perhaps not a space problem, but maybe with a population, a large population, is India. I just see them as the default option for emerging market exposure, Dawn. I can't see people investors globally for emerging market exposure trying to put money into places like South Africa or any other place for that matter. India is kind of the default go-to place potentially.
Well, you know, I mean, India, and I've traveled to India. I mean, it makes me sound like a bit of a globetrotter in that. And, you know, India is the most fascinating place to watch. And there's absolutely no doubt that they are well-educated in the main, right? They have a massive poverty problem, but worse than ours, quite frankly, when you see the absolute dire poverty in places like Delhi and Calcutta. You know, it can bring tears to your eyes when you see just how dire it is. But the one thing about India, and I think I did allude to this in the newsletter, is that what everybody's saying about, you know, not saying about deglobalization, it's not deglobalization. It's let's get the hell out of China. Right?
Yeah, sure.
And it's just, it sounds discriminatory. It is discriminatory, which is why they're probably pussyfooting around it a bit. But at the end of the day, it isn't let's bring it all back home. We're not hearing, yes, there's a little bit of bring it back home, but the reality is that the cost of labor is prohibitive in some of these Western countries to bring some of this labor back home. But you've got places like India, like Vietnam, Malaysia, Philippines, etc., that are only too happy to take that over. And that at least will do two things, because it will spread the risk, because unless they sort of put everything in India like they did in China, which would be a really big mistake, because make no mistake, India will do exactly the same reverse engineering that China has done, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm just looking at the economic growth. I mean, 8.4% between October and December. Which emerging market has been able to achieve that? I mean, South Africa can't achieve that. I mean, at 8.4%, if you continue to grow your economy 8.4% quarter on quarter, you know, that's October to December. Yearly, you grow your economy like you did the Chinese economy, suddenly your poverty problem becomes a much lesser of a problem, because a lot of those people get sucked up into the economy. They get educated. They provide opportunities for their offspring, so to speak. And you have an India that starts flourishing. I'd probably say that if you're going to put money in an economy, India has to be on your radar. You have to surely look at something like that.
I think one of the interesting aspects of this India story is that quite a bit of that growth is to do with the cutting of subsidies. And again, this is unpopular. Yeah. You know, this doesn't play into anybody's populist agenda, as you know, when they cut subsidies. And the massive subsidies that you find right across India has been one of their major stumbling blocks to joining this sort of global revolution. You know, going back to two, 3 decades or so, the US and Europe were saying, yeah, we'd love, you know, we want to bring McDonald's in. And they'd say, yes, but, you know, rather like what South Africa does, you know, we'd like to bring in Starlink. Yes, but you have to give us half of it, kind of thing. You know, exactly the same thing that is happening here, is that we want to have our cake and eat it. So this cutting of subsidies, and I think we're already starting to see it a bit in Europe. I mean, it was one of the major driving factors behind Brexit, was, you know, getting fed up of paying all these subsidies to all the farmers, bearing in mind that no farmers, no food, no people, right? So, you know, be careful. You know, I really don't join that sort of bandwagon of bashing the farmer. And, you know, I'm sure it must be extremely inconvenient in places like Paris at the moment, where the farmers are blocking the roads and dumping horse manure and cow manure and pig manure in the streets. And but at the end of the day, you know, economies need to stand on their own, but there is going to have to be a certain level of subsidy. If there's not subsidies, there's going to have to be import control, right? Which is what the problem is in Europe at this point in time, is that because Ukraine can't export to its usual markets, which are places like Egypt and the Middle East and that kind of thing, because their ships can't get through, and this is unpopular, de facto dumping it in Europe at a reduced cost, without having to jump through the same hoops that the European farmers are. So, yeah, it's complicated.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely, Dawn. But that's growth, right? Growth is complicated. I mean, I think what's interesting for me is to see the world and how it shifts and how investment themes shift across the world and, you know, how they become very much a focus area. Dawn, interesting, I've written a piece this week around Bitcoin because I've got a lot of people phoning me now again and saying, listen, so how about crypto? What's happening with crypto? Now, if you haven't seen yet, I mean, Bitcoin only a couple of months ago was at roughly circa $28,000, and that's now pushed ahead and it's over $60,000. As a matter of fact, it ended the week at $62,000. And look, obviously, now suddenly the bulls are out in full force, showing you how much money they made. Most of those bulls were very, very quiet when the price was going the other way. But that just shows you how the life in this asset class continues to show up. It's not just a case of, listen, this is a Ponzi scheme, or it's a make-believe type thing. This is an asset that is firstly hugely volatile. It's gone through massive volatility over time. But here we are back at $62,000. Now, I think one thing to take into consideration, and I don't know if people know this, but Bitcoin every 4 years go through a halving. That basically means the number of coins that are in issue halves. And the reason for that is every time during the life on a daily basis when Bitcoin gets traded, it gets traded through blocks. And when a new block is added to the chain, so to speak, then new coins get minted. That's how Bitcoin miners basically get paid. They all fight for these coins in order to make sure that they can add the next block to the chain, so to speak. So there's always new ones being minted. And the reason behind the halving is to try and keep in check the number of coins that are in circulation. Obviously, if there's demand, what happens to the price? Well, the price goes up. And we are about to go into a halving, and that has got to do with this. Notwithstanding that, global liquidity is helping not only this asset class, but all other cryptocurrencies rise in price as well. So if you look at some of the other large ones, in a similar fashion, those have gone up as well in price. Perhaps not as strongly as Bitcoin, but those have gone up as well. When does all of this end? Well, 2140, which is 117 years from now. I won't be around. Dawn, perhaps you will be around still. I see a smile. But in the year 2140 is when the halving stops. And that's kind of then becomes a base value for Bitcoin. Then it becomes more a store of wealth than it becomes about a minting process, so to speak. But that's the methodology around it. And this is why you're seeing a lot of this happening. If you saw a minting process and a halving process happening during a recession and when there was less liquidity, you wouldn't see this absolute price rise as far as the asset is concerned. And now the question is, so why don't more people just own Bitcoin? Well, I think number one, who are you? What is your objective? What are you trying to achieve with your money? These are all very, very pertinent questions to ask to make sure that the assets that you own fit your specific scenario and who you are. Remember, at the end of the day, Bitcoin has a certain high volatility level that has to be baked in to your understanding of your total assets and how they need to achieve whatever it is that you need to achieve. This is why financial advice is so important, because if you don't understand these things and you're just trying to chase certain return over time, you might have surely lost on the other side of that trade.
Yeah, Kobe, and I think we reiterate this time and time again in places like our newsletter, is that a growth asset, Bitcoin and equities and REITs, yeah, quite frankly, fall into that, yeah, category, are volatile. And if, yes, you want to see the normal or average returns for that asset class, then you have to wait a period of time of around about 5 to 8 years to see through a cycle and get that return. If that upsets you unduly, or if you need your money before that and you need capital preservation, then you need to put other asset classes into your mix in order to do, yep, that. And that's part of the conversation I have all the time with my clients. And they know that they're welcome.
Yep, sure.
If they don't understand it and they say, oh, Dawn, this has dropped. I had a conversation with one of my clients, and please excuse me, if you're listening to this, around an offshore investment. Now, we report our offshore investments in dollars, but I also report them in rand. And that can be misleading and upsetting, right? I've almost got to the stage where I'm not going to transfer it into rands, because then when the rand depreciates, everybody thinks, you know, we've shot the lights out, when it's not true. And when the rand depreciates, it's vice versa. So it's a difficult asset when it's offshore, because you have the currency or the exchange rate sitting there as a multiplier, right?
Yeah,
it
sure.
multiplies or divides or distorts in some way or form the actual return in the native currency. And that's quite a difficult concept to stomach sometimes, right? Because it just increases the volatility even more on an already volatile class. And no wonder some people just get seasick with it all.
No. Look, somebody else that's seasick at the moment is Weight Watchers International, or the WW company. Dawn, you've written quite an interesting piece this week around Oprah Winfrey, obviously having been on their board, now stepping down from this business. But it's interesting because Weight Watchers have been under pressure for a long period of time. You know, this is a company which over time have missed revenue. You know, over a 10-year period, revenues are down 6%. Over a 5-year period, revenues are down 11%. So this is a company which has just perennially been just battling. And this is as their business model around the weight watching product has slowly been overtaken by drugs. You know, I'm talking about the weight management drugs, you know, the pharmaceutical and the medical stuff that you could potentially take. And obviously, that, Dawn, must be much easier to take because you put an injection in your arm relative to having to go through the whole process of trying to follow the Weight Watchers type process. So the stock itself, you know, if you go back, you know, to kind of the midpoint of 2023, was over $10 a share. That stock is now $3.38. And they're continuously trying to turn this business around. It's a tough job.
Yes. And I mean, in the newsletter, I do allude to, you know, the dangers of having celebrity endorsement, because, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this is because Oprah Winfrey has gone off their board and it resulted in a nasty drop, further drop in their share price. This is a problem with celebrity endorsements, is if they have a bit of an upset in their brand. And listen, this is not the first time that Oprah Winfrey has, you know, sort of damaged her brand in many respects. She's not the same respected person that we knew a decade ago. I mean, I said to you offline, in my opinion, they should have dropped her a decade ago. Because, you know, she has not been a good role model for Weight Watchers for a long time. And now abandoning all sort of calorie counting and all those hard things that you have to do when it's in Weight Watchers for something along the lines of Ozempic or Wegovy is gone completely against the brand. And that is the problem you have when you have a celebrity endorsement. They don't just abandon you and your philosophies, but they actually start adopting behavior that is in complete contrast to your philosophy. And that's a problem.
I mean, Weight Watchers, I mean, it's a business in flux. And they're obviously attempting to right the ship. They're attempting to try and put things back together. They're trying to get subscriber growth going again. And then as part of that, they bought a company in 2023 called Sequence, which is a telemed business. Now, Sequence is a business which prescribes these weight loss drugs, because obviously you need to go through a process. It's a medical drug. You can't just, you know, you can't just hand them out to individuals. So they've actually now gone and they've actually bought this business so that they can try and see what kind of revenue they can generate, you know, from having a different angle on weight loss. But that just shows you how companies are continuously trying to evolve. They're trying to build out a business with a moat attached to it. And there's a vast amount of work involved in this process in order just to try and survive and just being able to try and keep it going. Weight Watchers International is clearly in that space. At $3.38, you know, down from $10.78. I, you know, imagine you bought the stock at $10.78, you know, thinking, listen, this business is cheap. You know, potentially, you know, from this point forward, they, you know, how much more downside can there be? Well, clearly a lot.
Colby, it's interesting because, you know, perhaps they actually didn't think this whole thing through, because there is ample evidence already that Ozempic, you have to keep taking Ozempic, otherwise you put the weight back on, especially if there hasn't been any behavioral change. And what Weight Watchers is good at is behavioral change. That's what their whole philosophy is around. So if they've now can prescribe, say, something like Ozempic or Wegovy, get across to their clients, look, over the time that you're losing weight faster than you would on Weight Watchers, if you do not change your behavior over that period of time, you're going to be back at where you started in just a short space of time. And look, these drugs do not come without side effects. And they also don't know what the long-term side effects, you know, what they do, one of the things that they do is slow down the digestion through the stomach. And that can cause, in fact, blockages, right? Which is very nasty. And you can end up in surgery as a result, you know, because it slows it down to nothing and then starts actually putrefying inside your gut to be not very delicate.
Oh, gosh.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
You know,
Unfortunately, I like sweet things way too much, Dawn. Way too much.
And you don't have an ounce of fat on you either. Right.
Thank you, Dawn. That's a compliment, guys. That's a compliment right there. Well, that's all for the week, folks, and thank you for listening. If you aren't already subscribed to our website, head over to rexsalon.co.za and wait a second for the pop-up to appear. This has been Dawn Riddler and Kirby Lakhranji for the Rex Salon Invest podcast, the home of wealth ecology. Catch you next week.